the noise squared. This is the square. You won't see, you won't be able to take the signal out of the noise. And this is the result in time domain. I mean, you do the correlation in frequency domain. I mean, you do the multiplication in frequency domain. You divide by the noise because, of course, you don't want to count region in the frequency where there is a lot of noise. And this is the output of the correlation. You get a huge spike in correspondence when you use the right template. Of course, if you use the wrong template, the spike doesn't go to zero immediately. I mean, it diminishes its height, but I mean, for this signal in particular, basically, you didn't really need much filtering. You just look at the data in bandwidth and you saw. But I mean, this is just to introduce you to the importance of waveforms. Waveforms are used to correlate, and unless you use the right waveform, the correlation doesn't give you the spike, or it's even worse, you might use a bad waveform. And so the spike is still there, it's not optimal, and then you get some bias on the parameter. So, and that's all what I'm going to say on that analysis. Now we are at the bulk of what I'm going to tell you. So where fundamental physics enter in the construction of the waveform. So let me simplify things a bit, but this is really the core of the business of theoretical input into the waveform. Basically, we assume that the waveform is an amplitude times the cosinus of a phase. This is better describes the in-spiral. I mean, this adiabatic approximation, but of course, I mean, this is full generic. You can always write as an amplitude times the cosinus of a phase. So there is a fundamental definition that we'll be using all throughout, is that this invariant velocity is related to the orbital frequency, omega. So you adimensionalize multiplying by m. And if you use Newtonian circular orbit, this relation is exact and relates the Newtonian velocity to the orbital frequency. Of course, you want to apply this to any other system. Since omega is always well-defined, but velocity is not always well-defined in a strongly gravitational system, then in full generality, you define the invariant velocity as this combination of the orbital frequency. And of course, you can relate the orbital frequency to the frequency of gravitation wave just by a pi. And then the other parameter that will be used all throughout, the symmetric mass ratio. Most of you are very well familiar with it, just the ratio of the reduced mass with the total mass. Okay, now there are two fundamental ingredients in theoretical physics that theoretical physics has to compute from GR to get from GR to the waveform. One is the energy function and one is the luminosity function. As you know, the energy function in Newtonian physics will be just minus the kinetic energy, of course, minus, no, because the binding energy is minus twice the kinetic energy, so the sum is minus the kinetic energy. And then we'll have all sorts of corrections, and notice that this correction will go in powers of v square because it's an energy, so it cannot depend on the sine of v. So we will have a correction of v square, v fourth, and all sorts of corrections here will have to depend on dimensionless factors, so cannot depend on the total mass. The total mass is factored out, but will depend on the mass ratio and the dimensional spins, of course. This is not enough because, of course, if you just have the energy of a conservative system, it will stay in circular orbit forever, so it will be very boring to look for monochromatic signals in gravitational wave data. So you need also the luminosity function. Then this is the prediction of the quadrupole formula, V to the 10. And then you have all sorts of corrections. Again, you have correction starting from V square. And the coefficients has to be dimensionless, so cannot depend on the mass, but depends only on mass ratio, dimensional spins. And in the luminosity, you don't have the argument that it has to be invariant and the time reversal, so you do have V cube correction, V4, V5, V6, V7, and so on. You just happen not to have V, but all the other odd terms are there. So these functions are now known up to 4pn, the energy function, so up to V to the 8. And up to V to the 7, the luminosity function. And again, this is basically gravitational wave 101. How do they enter to compute the phase? Well, the phase is just the integral over the angular velocity. And so then you make a change of variable, and then you replace, this is the luminosity d in dt. Take the derivative of the energy respect to V, d simplify, dv simplify, this is omega dt again, but written in a way that plugs in the real dynamics of the problem. So this is the way to fold in the dynamics of the problem into the phasing. Of course, this applies well to the spiral. I mean, basically all of the detection LIGO-Vigo is made, they include the merger in down. So you cannot rely on this kind of series for the detection. But I mean, this is the setup to build a waveform. And so you take this ratio of the energy function derived by the velocity and the luminosity function, and then you get the phase. And you see why it is important to get to high order, because the leading order is 1 over v to the 5. I mean, 1 over v to the 6, once you integrate, is 1 over v to the 5. So v is usually small. So unless you plug in correction up to v to the 6, up to 3pn, then you get correction in the phase of order 1 or more. So these are the famous or infamous post-Newtonian coefficients in the phase. So you see, this is the 1pn, this is the 3pn, and then at high pn order you start to have fancy effects like v to the 8. You start to have absorption effects in the spinless case. If you have spin, it comes in earlier. At v to the 8, you start to have tail effects. I will explain in detail what the tail effect is. At v to the 10, you start to have tidal effects. I mean, we heard a lot about tidal effects on Tuesday, and also memory effects. I will concentrate on black holes. So tidal effects actually are zero for black holes, at v to the 10 at least. The memory effect is not. And actually, I'm describing in detail what is preventing us to complete the fifth order in post-Newtonian expansion that we are having. There are several groups that are on this problem, and we can quite agree on what is this effect at v to the 10. So v to the 4, v to the 8 for pn, we all agree. V to the 10, there is some issue we have to, hopefully in a matter of few months or weeks will be solved. Okay. If you want to know where all the zoology of waveform comes from, well, basically you take this ratio here, and each of numerator and denominator, they are both series in V, and then you do different resummations of this series, or you do different expansion, you solve first in V and then V of T, and then you get all the zoology of Taylor T1, Taylor T2, Taylor T3, Taylor T4, Taylor T5, just to give you one example. From the energy flux balance equation, you get this relationship. See, if you expand the Taylor series in V in the denominator on this side, and then you bring in on the other side, you get one Taylor expansion. If you leave the denominator, you add another Taylor expansion. And of course, in one of the two cases, you can integrate analytically. So you have closed formula. In some other cases, you can only go numerically. So all of this prescription of how to expand this ratio, in this ratio, as I said, in numerator and denominator, you have Taylor expanded terms. Of course, all these different prescriptions, they agree once you cut them at the known PN order, which is for the moment is 3.5, because as I said, energy is known up to 4, but flux only to 3.5. So when you mix them together, 3.5 is the most you know. But of course, if you want to use phase value, this expansion, then they disagree if you include all the terms high V order. And this is a nice recent review. I took part in it, but of course, this is ultra standard stuff you find in many GR textbooks. Okay, this was the post-Newtonian. And what is the heart of the post-Newtonian is the idea is to compute the potential, I mean, the correction to the Newtonian potential, post-Newtonian, post-after Newtonian. But this is not the only approximation framework. For instance, coming from the particle physics point of view, it would be more natural to expand in the coupling in G-Newton. So you might have one post-Minkowskian, that would be G to the 1. So Newtonian potential is the one post-Minkowskian correction to straight motion, and then you would have two post-Minkowskian and so on. So what is the main difference between post-Newtonian and post-Minkowskian? Well, in post-Minkowskian, for instance, this is already the first order perturbative process. So this is a Feynman diagram, but you know, you could think of it as something in real space, no? There is a particle, a black hole moving. In absence of interaction, it will move in a straight line. Another black hole moving on a straight line, and they exchange some gravitational field. So this would be the G to the 1 effect to the potential. And in order to compute it, you just put the energy momentum tensor of one black hole, the energy momentum tensor of the other black hole, and you, well, there is indices because the gravitational mode has few indices, and then you put the appropriate Green function, the Green function for gravity. I mean, even if it might be a bit complex to take into account all the indices of gravity, you know, it's just 1/k² modulo, I mean, all the intricacy in the polarizations I buried into this delta, which I won't tell you what it is. It just takes into account all the different contraction of the appropriate polarization. But the Green function is pretty simple. It's pretty simple as long as you are g to the one. But if you go to higher order, then computation soon become very, very difficult, even though some groups have arrived up to g to the four. So post-Newtonian with respect to post-Minkowskian does a major simplification. Instead of considering the full propagator, that makes it very hard to compute this thing, even though, as I said, people have arrived up to g to the four. Before saying that, let me give you another slide. Going to higher order, so it's quite a formidable task, even though, as I said, up to 4 p.m. we have the result. With some caveat, I will tell you now. With particle physics approach, basically computing just scattering amplitude for and computing all the with all the interaction up to g to the four, fourth order interaction. And basically, it's let me call it LA group because most of the people are based in University of California, Los Angeles. So this is their more recent result, which arrives at g to the four for post-Minkowskian. There is another group based in Daisy in Germany that uses another approach, which is computing the scattering of unbounded system. And apparently, this is another very, very efficient method, but I won't tell you about because I don't work on that, but it's a very beautiful method. And they also got to g to the four. And then this from the point of view of people using effective field theory methods or scattering methods. And then there is kind of old school, led by Damour, that is blending in results from all different approaches, including more the most, say, orthogonal of the method is the so-called self-force. The idea of self-force is that instead of expanding in interactions, you expand over Schwarzschild. So you take a very massive object, and if you take a test body around the test around a very massive object, you know everything, of course, since you can solve the problem in GR. Then the problem comes when you want to include the back reaction of the test body, when the test body is not really so test, and you want to include the effects of the curvature of the small body, then you start to have you can have a perturbation theory in the ratio of the masses, or again, in rather the symmetric mass ratio. So results are known up to the first order and partially up to second order in the symmetric mass ratio. So only first order in beyond Schwarzschild is fully known. So these are other approaches. I will not tell you much about these other approaches. Now I will go back to post-Newtonian, which is mostly what I do. But this is just to tell you there are different communities that are we are absolutely communicating, of course, to cross-check our results. And indeed, the problems that we are seeing now, they come exactly from cross-check. They don't turn out right. Okay, so how does things get complicated when you go to G-square, say, for instance? So again, this is doable. This is not too difficult. But just to give you a flavor of what are the difficulties that you hit, is that, for instance, here, you have to consider the one black hole emitting one gravitational mode. And this gravitational mode doesn't interact directly with the other black hole, but with the self-energy of the other black hole, you see? Because here, the other black hole source is something which is gm squared. So this is the self-energy of the second black hole orbiting, giving a source for the gravitational field of the first black hole. So you have to do this integral over the Green function. You have one Green function here, one Green function there. So you have three Green function. Here you have two momenta because in gravity, each vertex has always exactly two derivatives. And so here you get already a complicated function. It's not too complicated that it cannot be solved, but it is complicated. One crucial point is that all these processes that I'm considering. So do not involve radiation to infinity, because then I would be computing the luminosity function. Okay, I would be computing the waveform. Now I'm really focusing on the conservative energy. So whatever happens between the black hole stays between the black hole. There's no emission to infinity, so this is conservative process. And to make things simpler, I will focus on longitudinal modes. You know, gravity is responsible both for attraction and for radiation. And the two things are qualitatively different, not only quantitatively, but are qualitatively different in the sense that, you know, gravity is ranked to 10, so 10 components, 4 are pure gauge, 4 are longitudinal, and 2 are really radiative. So the computation which is easier to do is when the two black holes, they exchange only longitudinal modes, real potential modes. When they start exchanging radiative modes, and they do affect the conservative energy, you see radiative modes can be emitted to infinity, but can also be emitted and reabsorbed. So for the moment, let's put aside the exchange of radiative modes. Let's focus on the exchange of potential modes. And these things make this simplification makes things much easier. As a historic note, the fact that not all of the 10 or 6 after gauge fixing components of the gravitational tensor, that not all of them are radiative, you know, wasn't appreciated immediately, not even by Einstein. So there is a famous note by Eddington, who was one of the first to understand general relativity in the 20s, by saying that, you know, there are two radiative modes and the other propagate with the speed of thought, in the sense that they can propagate with whatever speed you might think of, because they're not propagating. But Eddington was one of the first to understand it, and until 40 years later, there was not consensus. I mean, 30 years later, there was not consensus in the physics community about the separation of radiative and longitudinal mode. But Eddington got it right first. Okay, so what you can do, if you focus only on longitudinal modes, some modes that are not radiative, that are not propagating with the speed of light, but they only carry information about the source, you see, you can do the following. You can Taylor expand the Green function. And when you Taylor expand the Green function, you have 1 over k squared, and then k squared, k naught squared divided by k squared, k naught 4 divided by k to the 4. And that makes things much easier, because then you have a monomial to integrate over. You don't have an ugly function k squared minus k naught squared. And then there is another fundamental observation, is that this ratio, k naught divided by modulus of k, is of order v, actually order v squared. Okay, so these are really V-square corrections. So you know how to treat them perturbatively order by order in a post-Newtonian expansion, where V is the expansion of parameter. And these integrals are very simple. You see, e to the chi x divided by k squared is a very simple integral. And so you can reiterate at higher order. And then you may think, okay, but who tell me which Green function to use? Shall I use Feynman Green function, retarded, advanced? Well, when you expand longitudinal modes, it doesn't make any difference, because the difference between a Feynman Green function or retarded advanced Green function, it only appears when you go on shell, when the mode can go on shell, when k naught is equal to k squared. But this is not true ever for longitudinal modes. So as long as you use longitudinal modes, you can use whatever Green function you want. In particular, the G Feynman has a real part, which is the average between retarded and advanced. And the retarded advanced Green function is 0 imaginary part, whereas the Green function, the Feynman Green function, has an imaginary part which is non-zero only on shell. So when the modulus of k is equal to the omega, to the frequency of the gravitational mode. You see, this is crucial for the simplification. So that basically you expand the series in this way. And look at another nice thing is that also the integral over k naught become very simple, because the dependence on k naught simplifies. And you see the integral of e to the k naught t times k naught to any power is just the derivative of a delta function. So this is really a major, major simplification. And okay, one other thing I have to mention, you see, when I say that G retarded and G advanced are real, I mean in direct space, of course, therefore the transform is complex, but in direct space they're real, whereas the Feynman Green function is not real, not even in direct space. But indeed it has an imaginary part which is related, which is relevant, otherwise the optical theorem wouldn't work. But I will talk later about the optical theorem. Okay, so this is to tell you that things get very much simplified by this expansion in velocities. And what does it mean that when I expand, I have k0 over k, which is of order v? And the integral over k0 just gives birth to a plethora of delta function. Is that, let me give you this example. So if I have two black holes orbiting around each other, so general relativity tells me that black hole here fills the black hole there, whose motion is affected by the other black hole at a retarded time, which is affected by the black hole at a retarded time. I mean, it's a mess. You should integrate over the full history of the other one to know everything. In the post-Newtonian, by that expansion that I show you, what you do is the following, is that the black hole here is affected by the other black hole exactly at equal time, of course. Relativistically, this cannot be correct. And it's not correct, but it's approximately correct. Because all the correction due to retardation, you fold it in by adding derivatives of the trajectory. And you know that if the trajectory is analytic, by the derivative of the trajectory reconstructs the full trajectory. So yes, this post-Newtonian expansion is exactly the same as full general relativity, but it's expanded over retardation. So all the retardation effects are added order by order in V, because anyway, since the two black holes are not moving at the speed of light, we can do this expansion. Okay, so basically we trade fully local theory of general relativity for a Newtonian-like theory with action at instantaneous action at distance, and we reintroduce the retardation by these effects that depends on the derivative of the trajectory. This is standard PN. I mean, you read a paper from the 70s, from the 80s, from Blanchet d'Amour. This is standard. Okay, so what happens? There is a price to pay for this approximation. And the price to pay is the following. Look at this. When I expand K0 over K square, I mean, the advantage is that give a massive simplification in the integrals. The disadvantage is the following. Look at this. When you go to higher order, say K0 to the n divided by K to n, and then when you hit the derivative, the K0, you trade it for a time derivative, and you hit the time derivative to the exponential here, you see, at the numerator, you get terms with K to the 2. At the denominator, you get terms with K to the 2n. That means that once you want to perform this integration, the K, you have to be very careful about the infrared limit of this integral, you see? Because here you have few Ks, at the denominator, you have as many Ks as you wish if you go to high order. And this is a potential, actually, if you keep using post-Newtonian at high order, this will give you problem because you will hit infrared divergent integrals. So, you know, in a theory, if you claim that your model is describing nature, you cannot have infrared divergences. No? It means that your model does not work at large distances when gravity is weak. This is very bad. I mean, so option A, you throw away your model. I mean, it sucks. Option B, you fix it. Here, this is a simple way to fix it, which is basically the idea is that here we are summing only over longitudinal modes. Okay, longitudinal modes have this property that they have the space part much larger than the time part. But when the space part goes to zero, it doesn't make sense to say that the space part is much larger than the time part because it is going to zero. How can it be much larger? You have to be very careful. So this is a problem that was known in particle physics since long ago. And basically, you can point to standard literature that show how to circumvent this problem in standard literature. The problem is that you are hitting this spurious infrared divergence, which is not in GR, just in your approximation of GR, just because you are cutting the Green function in this way to simplify computation. If you reintroduce the part of the Green function that you arbitrarily cut, you get rid of the divergence, as it should be, because general relativity cannot have divergences at large distance. And basically, these were the two original papers that did this in particle physics context, and we redid the derivation in the context of post-Newtonian expansion. Okay, this is to treat the first potential problem that you hit. The other real problem that you hit when you go to high order, even though post-Newtonian simplifies a lot the computation, still you have to do ugly integrals. In particular, this is the Feynman diagram, which is the ugliest to compute. Here there is an integration over four internal momenta, so it's a for loop. And we found out, talking to people who do this, who compute Feynman integrals for life, I mean, for CERN, that, you know, this wasn't possible. And actually, they told us, oh, but look, this diagram looks like this one. I mean, here are the two black holes propagating and exchanging a lot of, don't care about the color, exchanging a lot of gravitational modes. And they say, oh, but this diagram we can write like this because this black hole is just a source or sink of gravitational mode. It doesn't change its momentum because, imagine, the black hole is one solar mass. It doesn't care if it emits a little bit of gravitational modes. So this is the same as a for loop self-energy diagram in gauge theory. So here, this diagram has the same topology of this. It's just that the two black holes here are collapsed to one line just because they don't change their status. They don't change their motion by emitting gravitational modes. And what happens is that this diagram was known, but in four dimension, because of course people do particle physics in four dimension. Here we were in a different slightly problem because we were in three dimensions. Remember, because the time is separate, the k zero part of the Green function is put apart. So there was a little bit of work to reuse the result of four loop particle physics to translate into three dimensions. So we got this master integral. So we realized that actually it was decomposable as the sum of few other master integral. And in particular,
may I ask a question about this? Sure. So like, does it matter like if you have spinning like black holes?
Oh, well, adding the spin will introduce other interactions.
Because the doing this trick like requires that the vertex are the same, right?
No. You can add whatever vertex, provided you write. This is the topology. One thing is the topology. One thing are the vertices. So the topology has to do with how many Green functions you put in here. So you see, the Green function has to do with the denominator of the integral. The vertices has to do with the numerator. So how the particle couples to gravity, coupled to with two derivatives, coupled with one derivative, one spin, coupled with zero derivative. I mean, that is completely, usually doesn't make the integral more difficult. It's just more tedious. But I mean, if you just give me the denominator, I can tell you if I can do the integral or not, no matter what is the numerator. Usually the numerator can only make it easier, doesn't make it more difficult. So if I can do the integral with the numerator equal to one, I can do with any other numerator. I mean, it involves a lot of elbow grease, but no obstruction of principle. Okay. So so we realized there was only one master integral that wasn't known, but actually in particle physics has been computing before in four dimension. So in three dimension was known numerically. And so what actually our collaborator Pier Paolo and Christian did was make a fit of a mathematical constant to that numerical result to obtain an analytic result. So this was the analytic result of this master integral that was known in four dimension, that was not known in three dimension, because we want to integrate only space dimension. And so we managed to get it for the first time. And later, Damour confirmed it up to this order. So this was done already 5 years ago. And so this was basically the last obstruction to complete the four post-Newtonian. So it then happened that to go to one order more, to 5pn, no new master integral was necessary. Actually, this is a nice property of gravity that we could demonstrate. But I mean, it looks like a fun fact for the moment, so I won't talk about it. So just to tell you that the new very, very hard integral that we solved for 4pn also did it for 5pn. 5pn, there was no new master integral. And then one crucial question that you all should have asked yourself is that, look, but these are four loop gauge integrals in a quantum gauge theory. How do the heck they relate to a classical gravity theory? Well, the fact is, for instance, let's go back to more simpler integrals. So this is zero loop, this is one loop, and this is one loop again. No? Here the two particles, the two black holes exchange a momentum q. Here they exchange a momentum q that separates into q minus k and k. And of course you have integrate over the loop momentum. The point is that if you follow ever any quantum field theory course, you will say, hey, wait, this is a quantum diagram. And this is a quantum diagram. If you remember what has been taught to you in any standard quantum field theory course. And now I'm here to tell you that they lied. When they told you that this is quantum, they always lied to you. Yes, and not cheating. They really, why? Because in this diagram, you see here there is a massive body, and here there is the massless gravitational mode. When you write the propagator for the massive body, you have the momentum and the mass, and they scale differently with age. Basically, if you take the infinite mass limit for this object, which is the astrophysical case, this diagram gives a classical contribution. In the infinite mass limit, this diagram gives a classical contribution. So what we are interested in is always the Q over M going to zero, the infinite mass limit of all these diagrams has always a classical contribution. Even in QED, even if you did this in QED, okay, of course in QED you don't have this diagram because electromagnetism doesn't have self-interaction, but in scalar electrodynamics you would have this. And it's quantum there, apart from the fact that it involves pieces with the momenta and mass, and in the infinite mass limit, it's classical. So each of these diagrams is not fully quantum, it's not fully classical. This recipe of expanding the propagator and so on, and expanding the green function of the gravitational mode, allow us to pick the classical contribution, which astrophysically is the only one we ever care about.
Hi, Ricardo. I had a question about the previous slide.
Sure. Sorry if I didn't notice you earlier.
No, that's fine. I just showed up. So epsilon, I take it, that's dimension minus four, is that right? So why do you compute through order epsilon?
So all these diagrams are divergent. Yeah, very good question. All these diagrams are divergent, but these divergences are UV, are ultraviolet. So ultraviolet divergences are very different from infrared. So in infrared, you should really worry, because if you want a theory that describes gravity, you cannot accept infrared divergences, of course. But ultraviolet are very different because they go and affect the behavior of your theory at ultra short distances. So at ultra short distances, what happens is that these divergences can be reabsorbed by the addition of term in the Lagrangian, which are proportional to dimensionful factor, which are basically mass, Ricci, and so on. Basically, you add into the Lagrangian a term which is mass or proportional to Ricci or Ricci scalar or Ricci tensor, divided by epsilon, and you reabsorb this divergence. This is the right thing to do, because these ultraviolet divergences are all divergences that either vanish on shell, the Ricci scalar vanish on shell, or are reabsorbable by adding a counter term proportional to the dimensionful parameter of your problem. So they don't affect the potential, because they are reabsorbable by something that vanishes on the equation of motion. If I encounter a UV divergence that would be proportional to Riemann, then I would be in trouble. You see the difference? Because if I have a UV divergence that is proportional to Riemann, that to reabsorb it, I have to add to the Lagrangian something like Riemann divided by epsilon, then I'm in trouble, because the Riemann is not zero on the equation of motion. In particular, it's not zero in between the particles. So it would give a contribution to the potential. So that's basically what you expect if you model a black hole with a point. You know that the black hole eventually is not a point. You know that eventually you will hit finite size.
Okay, so I understand why you need the diverging terms.
Well, the diverging terms, they come out naturally of the computation. What I mean is that they are harmless. They don't contribute to the potential.
Right, but you need to verify that they can be canceled out by...
Yeah, of course, no. We did verify.
Okay, yes. So I understand that. I understand why you want the finite terms. I'm wondering why you need the epsilon terms, the linear in epsilon terms.
Okay, so this is just a choice of the... So we always encounter only 1/ε divergence. Just because of the choice of the master integral, we happen to bump into a 1/ε² divergence. But all physical diagrams, they all boil down. I mean, you see, this integral never enters alone. It always enters in some combinations. And this choice of master integral is completely arbitrary. I mean, what is physical is the process. I mean, what is physical is the sum of this process to all the other physical ones. And if you do sum all the process to get a physical contribution to the potential, what you get is only 1/ε. You never get 1/ε². And the 1/ε, you can reabsorb, as I said, by either adding counter terms proportional to the dimensionful parameters or counter term proportional to objects that are zero on the equation of motion, then as such do not contribute to the potential. Did I answer your question?
No, I'm still wondering about the epsilon terms, the linear in epsilon.
I just wrote it for you to show off, because we were able to, sorry.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Sorry, yes. They don't contribute to the potential. It's just that, you see, Damour couldn't do it, we could, so I wanted to show off, yes, but they don't contribute to the potential. I was answering to another question. Okay, so If you ever have to teach quantum field theory and you teach your student that this diagram is quantum, be careful, you're lying. This diagram always have a classical contribution. That is the only one that matters in the astrophysical limit, which is huge mass compared to the momentum exchange between the particles. Okay, this is something that from the particle physics point of view has been used, you know, since the 50s, basically since the invention of field theory applied to scattering. And basically, one thing is crucial though, that, you know, this k momenta you have to integrate, in principle integrate from zero to infinity. So if you're not careful to take the limit that kills them before doing the integration, then of course your computation is screwed. I mean, because first you send to zero everything that is k over m, and then you integrate over k. If you do the opposite, if you first integrate over k, then you lose. I mean, since k you integrate up to infinity, then you screw completely your result. Okay, so the two limits you don't compute, you first do the physical one and then you integrate over all k's. So this is something that was very well known in particle physics in scattering computation. And basically, so what is called in scattering computation is this method of regions. So what you do is you say, when I integrate, I just keep the terms that are not in the region of momenta that I don't care about. Provided, I mean, be careful. I'm still integrating from zero to infinity, all the internal momenta. But before doing this integration, I get rid of the region of momenta that I don't care. So the only two region momenta that I care for astrophysical classical application are this potential region, which are the longitudinal modes that have the space part much larger than the time part, and the radiation mode. The radiation mode have the space part in modulus equal to the time part. Of course, the radiation has modulus of k equal to omega by definition. Okay, and this is just to summarize that, you know, this is a classical piece, which is actually the only one surviving in the infinite mass limit, and this is really quantum. This is really quantum, so we'll never have to deal about it, because it's quantum. By the way, this is computable, and it has been computed, I mean, 30 years ago by one of you other people, and it's finite, it gives a finite contribution, but it's, you know, it's suppressed with respect to this by h bar over L. And of course, the angular momentum for astrophysical system is 10 to the 70 h bar. So, I mean, you can compute it, but you don't do astrophysics with this. Okay, so the idea is now that I tell you, I mean, about the separation of mode, then you might be happy to know that, you know, what we do is basically we consider a near zone where we see the two objects separated by a distance r, but and in this near zone, only the longitudinal mode, only the potential modes matter. And then we have a far zone where we look for far away. So you see the binary system is now collapsed to a point, but this point now is not a black hole, it's a composite system, so which have all sorts of multiples, quadruple, octuples, and so on. And so we don't see the potential modes in between the two particles, in between the two black holes. What we see is the radiation, but the radiation has a much longer wavelength. No? The potential mode has a k, you know, a wave number, which is 1 over r. The radiation mode is r over v, and v is smaller than 1, so r over v is much larger than r. Okay. And so the idea is the following, is that you remember there was the infrared divergence that is very bad, is inconsistency of your theory. But you said, okay, that infrared divergence came when the momentum of longitudinal modes was very, very small. When the momentum of longitudinal modes is very, very small, is it really longitudinal? I mean, if it's very, very small, how can I say that the omega part of the Green function is much smaller than the k, which is very, very small? Fine. What you have to do, you have to keep the entire propagator, but if you keep the entire propagator, you're back to post-Minkowskian, which is difficult. I mean, it's doable, but it's difficult. So in the far zone, you do another approximation. Instead of expanding the Green function, you expand the exponential of the Fourier transform. You say, instead of having e to the I kx, I have a sum of polynomial of kx. Now, k is the momentum of the radiative mode, which is the long one, and x is the distance between the two black holes. So now this is the right parameter of the expansion in the far zone. And so you see, I again, not back in the post-Minkowskian. I don't want to go back to the post-Minkowskian, but I go to another regime of approximation inside the post-Newtonian. I keep the full Green function, and I use the expanding exponential. But now be careful, you have to put the right epsilon. Okay, here I call it A, but it's epsilon. I have to put the right boundary condition for the propagator, for the Green function. It cannot be Feynman, because Feynman, you know, it's appropriate for particle physics when you have incoming particles at minus infinity and outgoing particles at plus infinity. This is not astrophysics, huh? It's particle physics. I mean, incoming at minus infinity, outgoing at plus infinity, these are the boundary conditions described by Feynman, which are the boundary condition at LHC, which are not our boundary condition. Our boundary condition are retarded, or retarded, of course. You let the system evolve and you have radiation after the source has evolved, okay? And so you have to put in the right boundary condition, which is not Feynman. And this is can cause some glitches, just because if you want to borrow the integrals from particle physics, you have to be careful, because, you know, integral particle physics are Feynman, this is our retarded. But just be careful if you know it. Okay, so when you to tackle this problem of small momenta exchange in the near zone, you have to add the physics parameterized by radiation mode. Radiation mode are not only emitted to infinity, but are also emitted inside the system, emitted as absorbed. And this gives a contribution to the dynamic that actually, luckily that you got the infrared divergence here. Because if you didn't get the infrared divergence here, you might think, okay, this is all what we need. And you wouldn't realize that you also need the contribution from radiative modes exchange in between the particles. The presence of infrared divergence here tells you that no, this cannot be the whole story. And indeed, you have to add the radiative modes even in between the black holes, not only emitted to infinity. So as Sweben used to put it, I mean, the infrared divergence is your friend, it's not your enemy. So when you get it, it's telling you that you have to complete your problem. Okay, and this is the summary of basically the approach. So in the near zone, so when I can resolve the two particles, I have the whorl line of one particle, eventually the spin, and then a permanent quadrupole is the black hole as a permanent quadrupole in the case it has spin. And then you see I can also admit for a Riemann square. A Riemann square is really a finite size effect, because you see it doesn't go to zero on the equation of motion. It really tells you that there is an effect of finite size. This is in the near zone. In the far zone, I have something different. I have a blob, which is not a black hole. It's a composite system, and it has a mass, it has a spin, it has quadruple, and it has all sorts of multiples, because it's a composite system. And the nice thing of the far zone expansion is just it is the same thing as the multipolar expansion, because when you consider the quadrupole time the Riemann, or the octopoles time the derivative of the Riemann, you are automatically writing an expansion of V. Okay. The results in the positonian are now known up to 5 pn in the near zone, and not quite to 5 pn in the far zone. Why? I have 10 minutes. Yeah, please. I have 10 minutes, yes. What happens is that, so for the moment, I only told you about these diagrams in which I exchange potential modes in the near zone, and eventually I have to sum the exchange of radiative modes. But you see, here I changed also the shape of the Feynman diagram because of this. When I want to consider radiative modes, since I don't want to bump into the problem of having the ugly integral, I expand the exponential. And so I take the radiative modes with the full Green function, but then I collapse the two particles to one point. And so I collapse the two particles to one point with one composite object, which has quadrupole, octuple, and so on. And then I let it interact with itself with all sorts of radiative modes. And then I can also consider the emission. So these two diagrams, they account for conservative physics, and this diagram account for dissipative physics. I mean, I can also emit stuff and contribute to the nominalism function. Okay, how to control the approximation? So there is a theorem. Let me skip the demonstration. The idea is the following, is that, remember I told you that this diagram is infrared divergent, and it points you to inconsistency of your theorem. There is an easy fix. I won't show you the demonstration, but believe me. The easy fix is that you just add the far zone diagram. See, this is a diagram in which the two black holes emit gravitational modes, and there is a cubic self-interaction. So this diagram has the same dependence on masses and on self-interaction as this one. This is the composite object in which a quadrupole emits a radiative mode, a quadrupole absorbs a radiative mode, and the mass here absorbs or emits a longitudinal mode. So it's radiation which is emitted, scattered over the curvature, and reabsorbed. And what happens if I just add this far zone diagram to the near zone diagram? I get that the two divergences cancel out, miraculously, but it's not a miracle, it's actually a theorem. And you see, you get a component to the divergence, you obtain some logarithm. And you see the logarithm combined nicely, you know, when and the arbitrary scaling the logarithm cancelled, and then you get the logarithm of omega r, which is basically v, and the standard log of v that enters the phasing at 4 p.m. I mean, to make a long story short, is that this spurious divergence goes away once you add the near and far contribution, when you are longitudinal and radiative contribution. Or if you dealt with pure with the entire GR from the beginning, you wouldn't have this problem. But this problem came in because of this simplification that we wanted to have in computing stuff. There's no infrared divergences. And you know, one nice thing that you can learn by applying this field theory method, suppose we only had the far zone theory. Okay. Suppose we don't, I mean, we look at the binary from above, from away, we don't know that it's a binary. We just see the far zone, so we just see the composite object with multiples. We do our computation, theoretical computations, oh, we struck into a divergence. This divergence from the far zone is a UV divergence, and it's perfectly fine, no? Because it's a composite object. If my theory has a divergence, a small scale of a composite object, that's fine. It just means that my model has to be completed by telling my model how the composite object is made. But this is what happens in particle theory all the time. No? Particle theories, we get plenty of UV divergences, and we say, okay, we don't know the UV completion of the standard model. And so what do you do? You get these logarithms, and then you get some, you know how to resum this, you know how to make sense of this arbitrary scale that enter the logarithms for regulating the divergence. And you can do prediction of the logarithms at higher order. Here we can do the same. We can pretend we don't know the near zone. We can use the divergence and this arbitrary scale in the logarithm of the far zone. We can resum it with particle physics method and then go and check with the result of full general relativity, because we know full general relativity at all scales. And the things matched very nicely. Okay, this was a note about the counter term of the UV divergence, but I already mentioned about it. But this is to tell you that, you know, here we don't really need, because we know far zone and near zone, we know the fundamental description. We can just compute both. But if we knew only the low energy theory, only the far zone theory, we would have this divergence and we would treat it like in particle physics when you don't know what happens inside the quarks. And you would do randomization group evolution and so on, like we did in this paper. And actually we did, there is some of terms that we basically got the logarithm up to any infinite order. Let me skip about this because it's technical. But just to tell you the result, we basically could find this non-perturbative formula for the logarithmic part of the energy. To, you see here, x is v squared, is the expansion parameter. So it's non-perturbative, this formula. And we could check this formula, since it's basically one cell force, one first order in cell force, we could check with the cell force result up to PN expanded cell force result, and up to where we could expand the cell force result in PN, which was 22 PN, it beautifully matches. But this is really non-perturbative. And this is based just on the knowledge of the far zone, so on the low energy theory. And just once you hit a divergence in the low energy theory that you know is not complete, because the far zone is not complete, because it's describing a composite system, which is, you know, at the end is made of two black holes, then you can know something about the full theory. Of course, just from the far zone, you cannot know everything. What we could know, for instance, here was just the logarithmic term of the energy at all orders. Okay, let me just, 2 minutes to tell you what is going wrong at 5 p.m. So, this is to tell you that we want to go to a higher order also for the emission. For instance, the coupling of the quadruple to the gravitational mode, that's the emission. The coupling, if you let the quadruple to be scattered by the curvature of the system, that's the famous tail, which is a V cube correction with respect to the standard emission. Then it can scatter not over the mass by the curvature source by the mass, but then we can scatter over the curvature source by the angular momentum of the system, then it becomes a V to the 5, or can be scattered over the curvature source by another radiative mode. So that's a Q square effect, which is the memory. So this name I don't have time to explain why this is called fail tail, but this is called tail and this is called memory because when you look at this, it depends on all the history of the binary. This is happens because since it's scattered, before reaching the observator, the observer, it's scattered, it doesn't go straight to the server. So the observer doesn't see the source at the retarded time, but saw it at some earlier time because since the wave is scattered, it takes more time to get the observer. But basically, it gives you the a snapshot of the source sometime before the retarded time, but not infinitely before the retarded time. Here is something different from the memory. I mean, they're both hereditary. They both depend on the history of the series, but this is called memory, and this is called tail, because this tail is like a strike of the tail of the cat that, you know, arrives a little bit later than the retarded time. The memory, no, because look at this. This is the quadruple. It has a 2 omega and minus 2 omega dependence. This is another quadruple, which has a 2 omega and minus 2 omega dependence. The combination of the two has 4 omega, 2 omega, 0, minus 2 omega, and minus 4 omega. So this effect has a 0 omega dependence. It has a time independent. It has a piece which is not time dependent. So that's why it is a memory, because basically it stays there forever. It gives you information for arbitrary early time, respect to arbitrary early time of the source. So this, again, this is, of course, we didn't find this. This was the famous Christodoulou memory, but just recasting this post-Newtonian language. So just to tell you, tail and memory are both hereditary effects, but they are very, very different phenomenology. So this has the standard 2 omega modulation, because you see the mass is constant, so it doesn't modulate the 2 omega behavior of Q. Whereas the memory has a constant piece, that's why it's called memory, because it gives you information really about the whole history of the source. It's really a constant offset. Now, to make a long story short, is that this introduces an effect of 5pn, this introduces an effect of 5pn, this is introduced an effect of 4pn, this is okay. So this is just radiation reaction that doesn't affect the energy. This is 4pn is okay, it has been checked in various methods. These two effects at 5pn, when we combine and we write down the potential and we check with post-Minkowski and other methods, they don't add up. So we have a problem. Apparently, the problem is due to the fact that radiation reaction does not contribute to the conservative energy, but radiation reaction square, yes, because radiation reaction is odd under time reversal. Radiation reaction square is even under time reversal. So radiation reaction square apparently does a contribution that affects the 5pn, and if we add everything together, it doesn't quite match with other methods. So this is where we are now, that we have a problem, and basically this was the argument. Okay, let me stop here. Okay, there is a very nice, elegant argument by Damour how to check that our result is correct. Applying his argument, it shows that our result is not correct. So we are, we are working with other groups to iron out this little, but potentially, very disturbing thing of why the 5pn cannot be complete with the radiation trigger effects. These are the potential, the exchange of potential modes to 5pn has been computed fine. When the exchange of these radial modes affect the conservative energy, apparently there is still something we have to understand. So, and this is to close, and just wanted to show you just a summary. You know, this is a table. If you look at vertically, these are PN order. If you look at horizontally, these are PM order. You see, this is always R to the cube. This is G cube. This is G4. So G4 has been computed completely, the 4PM, but only for the potential modes. For the radiative modes, we have this problem with this memory. We don't quite get the same result with different methods. Okay, I can stop here. Thank you.
So questions, either online or in the room? Maybe what people think, I have a question. So how much of what you have described has been tailored, or well, much of it has been tailored under the assumption of circular orbit? But if one were to translate or try to go after eccentric systems, mm-hmm. how much of this can you reuse? And do you envision any issues, mm-hmm. at least gaining some traction?
So when we compute the dynamics, that's in full generality. So it's really the dynamics of two bodies. Actually, one of the methods, the one promoted by the DESI group, is actually for hyperbolic encounters, but they found a nice way to relate hyperbolic encounter to bounded system, but bounded in general with generic eccentricity. So all the results which are consistent among the groups, they work for generic dynamics, eccentric, unbound orbit, bound orbit, whatever. The result we don't agree upon, there is some partial result in eccentric orbit that doesn't quite match the result for us. All this memory stuff is zero on circular orbits. So at the end, we all agree on circular orbits, but we don't agree on generic orbits. So, but no, the formula is completely general.
Anyone else? So Patricia, coming.
If you go back to your summary at the very end, that was the spinless case. Could you just give us a flavor of where we stand when spin is included?
I know there is a lot of development with spins, and I am afraid that so spin starts at 1.5 in the energy and in the flux with spin orbit. Then you have the spin at 2pn in the energy in the flux. These are well known. Up to spin square, I think they have reached the level of spinless and maybe overtaken. Up to from spin cube on, I don't know, I should look it up. But for up to spin square, all of this is known. And people are actually, many groups are actually developing computation to compute higher order spins and multiple spin interaction. But this is so actively developing that I lost track of it, sorry.
Yeah, it seems like next to leading order has been kind of the barrier for some time, right?
Yeah, then it depends how many spin to the n, you know, it's how many spin cubes, spin four, and so on. I cannot answer on the top of my head.
No worries, thank you.
But spin square for sure is not up to the level of spinless.
Any other question? So if not, let's thank Ricardo again.